Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and this week Les Klinger and I speak to Catriona McPherson. In our wide-ranging interview, Cat talks about writing the Dandy Gilver series of mysteries that take place in Scotland after World War I. Her standalones, one of which, The Day She Died, is a finalist for an Edgar Award, and why, although she is Scottish, she does not consider herself a tartan noir writer. She also talks about being the current president of Sisters in Crime, which promotes the ongoing advancement, recognition, and professional development of women crime writers, and how she came to be a transplanted Scot living in Davis, California. Here is Cat McPherson.
There's many things that we'd like to talk about today. I think we would like to have you at some point put on your official El Presidente hat and talk about Sisters, but that's not the principal focus of this. We want to talk about you.
We want to talk about you. We want to talk about the new book that's coming out in May. We want to talk about the book that was nominated for the Edgar.
And then we could talk about the book nominated for the Bruce Alexander Award. This is embarrassing, is it not? To have so many nominations?
I'm sitting, my head's blocking awards corner there. I know it's going not too badly. This is, I mean, the Edgar was, I was absolutely flabbergasted. I was gobsmacked. I lost control of my dialect completely, and sent a message to a US editor that I was chuffed as little mince balls, which didn't mean much in Minnesota.
What does it mean realistically? What do you think it means for you as a writer, Kat? You're at the point in your career where I'm not sure that it's going to suddenly boost sales, but maybe you think it will.
I don't know. I mean, I've no idea. I did notice there was an effect immediately of invitations and people saying, can you do this? Can you come here? Can you, there was that. It sort of crept up on me, that I've got so many books now, and I've been writing full-time since since 2005. And I should know more about all that stuff and be able to say, look, here's how it is, and explain it all. Like Laurie King just did the other night. I was interviewing Laurie King down at Kepler's the other night, and someone asked a question, and she just... erudition just flowed from her until I lost the stance of being the interviewer and I could feel myself going...
Laurie does have that tendency. I've done a lot of appearances with her and it's easy to just sort of let your mouth hang open and want to listen.
I don't know. It can't hurt, right? I mean...
Well, that's right. I mean, my personal feeling about it is it's the peer recognition that is most affecting, I think. I'm not sure that the writing community, that the reading community understands about the awards, but the writers certainly do.
I think that the thing with the Edgar is I've been an Edgar judge, well, Mary Higgins Clark Award, which is one of the smaller ones, and it felt as if I was, it was like Hogwarts owl letters, when you see the UPS guy, my office is at the front of the house, and you see still, sort of flashback when you see the UPS
guy. Well, I was on the nonfiction jury. I chaired the nonfiction jury this year, and I did it, I must say, very selfishly because I knew we'd only have 15 submissions. And they would all be books I'd want to read anyway.
I mean, it's not, but you know that it's serious. You know that it's taken seriously, and there's no. It's a shame you can't be done with all the covers stripped off and completely anonymous. But I mean, the anonymity wouldn't work anyway, would it? You'd know who it was. So it does feel. Yeah, it's a huge honour. I can't wait to find out who was on the panel. And maybe that's overly nosy, but we're writers. We are nosy, aren't we? I mean,
yes.
you let things go by. If you thought, oh, well, if you were bovine and uninterested, you couldn't write a story. So I am dying to find out. I'm not trying to find out.
It's too late to lobby anyway.
Isn't that great? Yeah, that feels really good. There's nothing you can do. You could be an even bigger PR disaster than is my default setting, and you can't do any harm now.
Are you planning to come to the dinner?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
good.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You've been before?
No, I've never been before. No.
I think this will be my 7th or 8th or something like that, maybe 9th. And it's just a wonderful party, a time to share with peers, with people who are writers and who get it, and who actually mostly dress up nicely, look pretty good.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, it took me about under a minute to think, what will I wear? You know, I sent my email that morning and saw the nomination. Yeah, it's shameful. It really is.
Well, it's further discrimination against women writers, you see, because the men writers have it so much easier. What'll I wear, the black bow tie or the navy blue bow tie, you know?
Right. You know, after the Oscars on Sunday night, when the red carpet analysis, it really annoys me that they use airtime on men. Why do they? Don't show us. I want to see Jay Leno. What's his name? Jared Leno? The one with the...
Yes,
oh,
yes.
Jared Leto. Yeah. Jared Leto.
Oh, that bit, yeah. Uh-huh. Don't show us the men. They all look the same. They all look wonderful. They all look the same every year. Anyway.
I think you hit on a wonderful concept for the Edgars that Marjorie needs to hear about, which is the red carpet.
Red carpet.
Yes, the Edgars need a step and repeat where people can be asked questions and Kat can be asked, and who are you wearing tonight?
Probably going to be from a thrift store or Ross Dress for Less. American writers are a bit more glamorous than British writers. But once upon a time, I went to an Orion party in London that was held in the same venue in London Fashion Week, and we were standing outside on a balcony on the first, what you'd call the second story, and you could tell with 100% accuracy as the taxi stopped who was coming to the publisher's party and who was going to London. There was no crossover at all.
So, Kat, why are you here? What brought you to California?
Oh, such a 50s reason. My husband got a job here. I came on a chattel visa. I came on a spousal visa and I wasn't allowed to work. That's the deal. The professors, he's a professor at UC Davis, and they get to come to work, but their appendages aren't allowed to work.
Well, you showed them.
Well, I thought, it can't be illegal to type in your own house, right? I mean, how can that be illegal? So I did, I worked quietly. And it was quite good, actually, because that was for 3 years, that even if I'd done the sensible thing and got a day job, or, you know, if I'd been sensible, I couldn't have got a day job anyway, so I just had to write my fingers down to stumps, because it was all I was allowed to do. There was a slight problem. I had got an American contract to sign the same day I had to sign something from the immigration people swearing that I had no American employment. I thought, ooh. My agent signed it for me, so we got round that. Maybe I shouldn't be saying this. She realized slightly differently. I've got a green card now. What can they do?
There you are. I don't think the FBI watches our podcast, but, you know, we'd like them to.
Especially if they're fans of mystery and thriller fiction. We definitely would like the FBI to listen to our podcast.
I think what I write is probably not going to be a great pool for FBI officers. That's why I'm here. We came, Neil... I used to be a university professor in Britain, and I packed it in to write stories, which made us more mobile because we're looking for one job rather than two. So I jokingly say to him, that's the only reason he got the job. They say in the interview, and what does your wife do? Is she a professor? And he said, no. And he said, you're in. We don't have to soak up a spouse. This is the boy for us. So he doesn't like that.
Good
but
planning.
It was a bit of a leap into the dark, but I can't say it's gone badly. It's wonderful. And you can't live at home. California's not bad, right?
So far, your choices have been to set your fiction out not in California. You set it in Scotland, in London. And are we going to eventually see a California setting for something, or what's your thoughts on that?
Yes, I think so. I said no for a long time. I thought I can't do this. I don't know anything. I don't know what's escrow. What does that mean? You know. Which way are you supposed to plug in a plug? It looks symmetrical, but it's not. I still can't work that out. Dandy Gilver, that 1920s detective that I write about, she's never coming to California. I know that. There'd be nothing here. It would be a cow town. But I think I will, but I don't think I could write an American voice character, an American protagonist. I don't know how Laurie does it. I mean, but Laurie's kind of almost English, right? Because of her aunts.
Yes, and she cheats a bit. I mean, you know, Mary is, of course, half American, and I think Laurie is sort of honorarily sort of half English. You're right. So
she is, yeah. Ask her about tea. She comes over very English.
Oh, yes.
Fiercely English. So I don't think I'd attempt that. I just couldn't get the depth of cultural knowledge. Someone was wearing a T-shirt recently with Mr. Rogers on it, and I said I thought Mr. Rogers was a horse, you know, to great hilarity. So just things like that, I'm never going to get. So I don't think I could. I don't think I could do it.
But at the same time, your novel that's going to be released in May has a Japanese young woman in a town on the outskirts of Edinburgh. And I think you did a marvelous job of talking, you know, from her cultural perspective.
Oh, you read
Scots.
Yeah?
Yeah, I've read about half of it.
I only got it
as an e-galley yesterday because Midnight Ink is down for the week or something.
Oh, it's sales conference week, isn't it? Oh, that's great to know because it's, you know, I'm hardly anyone's looked at it yet. She, funnily enough, though, this never occurred to me, but when I write a character who feels quite a long way from me, it comes out automatically as third person. So I've written two novels in third person and they both have protagonists that I think are a long way from my experience. And I didn't plan that. But Keiko Nishisato, when I did my PhD in Edinburgh, I had three office mates who were Japanese. And I took a long time. I spent 5 years with these three women, Etsuko and Mariko and Yuko. So, and then they helped a lot and picked their brains later to get things, you know, not the kind of obvious taking your shoes off style things, but things like, does babysitting work? You know, does that happen? Do young girls in Japan babysit for other people who are not in their family? Does that, you know, is that something that goes on? Or the things that you take for granted and that they would really clang if you got them wrong. So I'm hoping that I didn't make too much of a mess of it.
Well, she's a fascinating character, and the group of townspeople that she encounters, the tradesmen, is that what they're called?
The traders.
The traders. They're deeply, traders. Deeply creepy.
Yeah. I feel really affectionate towards them because they're the people of home for me. I mean, the wee lady next door and Mr. McKendrick, who's the head of the traders, I feel as if I know him so well. Because I know so many people like him.
But you do that, you know, you're absolutely right. It's sort of a benign sinisterness. You know, there's nothing quite you can put your finger on, but you know that there's something off about them.
Yeah.
Benign sinisterness. Now, that's a phrase. Okay.
But, I mean, I think Kat does that a lot. You have a way, especially in your standalones, of sort of imbuing your fiction with this kind of foreboding without saying, you know, it was a dark and stormy night. It's never a dark and stormy night, but, and yet, you know, just finding a sort of a dried out, desiccated letter just, you know, sends shivers up your spine.
Thank you. I got a comment yesterday, actually, from someone on Twitter who sent a message to say, it reminds me of reading Margaret Miller. I keep thinking I've got it, and then it twists away. And I thought, oh, that sounds good. And I keep hearing Margaret Miller, and I've never read her.
I believe it's Margaret Millar.
Millar. Oh,
and
okay.
She was Ross MacDonald's wife.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And she's a brilliant writer, and you know what? Whoever sent you that tweet is spot on, really, really spot on.
And she lived in California.
And she was a California writer, yes.
Yeah. Northern California, wasn't it?
No, lived in Santa Barbara.
Santa Barbara.
Oh, but I believe that her books are being reissued soon, because they're kind of hard to track down at the moment.
There's a really good Margaret Millar story in Los Angeles Noir Volume 2, edited by Denise Hamilton, one of our friends.
Oh, okay.
Can't you and Lori King both have an affinity for the 1920s?
Yeah.
What is it about the 20s?
Oh, it's not the 20s for me. It's the fiction. It's the golden age. So it's not the real 20s. It's that mythical place that's made up half of the real 20s and half of that British detective fiction. In that golden age fiction, a lot of the writers were trying to escape from the shadow of the First World War. But it's really hard now to go back and write then without dealing with the First World War. So I think that's the difference for me. It's not as light as it should be. I never wanted to write historical fiction. I wanted to write as though I was back then, you know, like take me back to then and write from there rather than to write from here about then. But I failed because the long shadow of the First War and then the looming, the foreshadow of the war that's coming. It's, you can't get yourself back before 1939 completely. My detective has got two teenage sons and it's 1932 now and it's here it comes. So always in my head there's this awful feeling that disaster is going to strike. And it's in the stories. Her husband is a god-awful bore, which is a lot of fun to write. But he also keeps up with current affairs. So he reads the papers and he's worried about what's happening in Germany. And she's ridiculous. You're such a fuss budget. You know, don't, we've had the war. Let's just enjoy life now. So I can take something that should be fun and turn it into something rather more desperate. But I like the. It's kind of. It's easy to write about Scotland in the 1920s because I haven't changed much physically. If you want to know what it looked like, you just go outside and walk around. I feel a bit highfalutin if I talk about research because mostly it's just tramping around looking at stuff and reading newspapers and diaries and things like that. I don't do anything very taxing. In fact, one time I set a story in a department store, two rival department stores, which is the best fun ever to research. I made up these two department stores. When I realised I really am not an academic anymore, I can do anything I want. I was thinking about, I wanted someone who played in a band, but off to the side, who wasn't the focus. I wanted an elderly trumpet player. Are you still here?
Yes.
Yeah. Who, and I thought, oh, maybe he could be in a circus band. And I went to a circus, you know, working hard for research, to look at how the music was produced and thought, oh, well, you know, I've got to use this for Dandy Gilover. This is amazing. There's so many ways to kill someone in a circus tent. And thought, I can't, can't write books in a circus. And it was four books in, and I thought, I absolutely can. I can do anything. So after that, circus, a boarding school, these rival department stores. I had her undercover as a servant in a great house in Edinburgh during the general strike. Nuns. Nuns are always hilarious, right?
Right. Mm.
Such, so funny. And ballroom dancing, that's the one I've just finished. I shouldn't talk about the nuns. I haven't written that one yet. Well, I'm halfway through. But sort of ballroom dancing halls in Glasgow at the height of the dance fever and the razor gangs. It really... I'm a slow learner, but it eventually I realised I can do absolutely anything. I don't have to research anything that's not going to be a hoot.
What delicious freedom. I assume this is why you became a writer, to write about what you care about.
Well, I should have. I mean, all the way through primary school, what you'd call elementary school, all my report cards were, she's dreamy, she stares out the window, she's full of nonsense, over-imaginative, doesn't, you know, just scatty, ditzy, all of this, making up stories all the time. But it took me until I was 35 to realise that if you write them down, instead of being sent to the headmaster for punishment, you get paid, and you call it a job. It's
so you found yourself in California, and you decided to write. Who were the writers that influenced you? Were they writers who wrote in the early part of the 20th century, or are they more current?
Oh, absolutely. Then, so 2001, I started, and it was Her Dottiness, Dorothy L. Sayers, and Agatha Christie, more Marple than Poirot, Michael Innes, I love. I think Appleby's End is one of the most outrageously bonkers stories that's ever been written. Niall Marsh and Marjorie Allingham and all of them. Absolutely. And I wanted to write another one like that. And I got a brilliant rejection of the first novel from a London publishing house, an editor that said, this is like something you find at the end of a wet week in a Norfolk holiday cottage. And I thought, yay, I've done it. Cracked it.
And then they said, but that was supposed to be a negative.
Yeah. But I knew that I'd got it right. I absolutely found the whenever I'm signing one of those first novels for someone now, I always want to say, please read it gently, because it was my first attempt. And, you know, first-time novelists never knowingly underwritten. And it does make me wince now, but...
So no Americans were on that list.
I know, isn't that awful? I read my first Nancy Drew last year. That's true. I'm now I'm desperately scrabbling to see if I can catch up. Nope, fail. Well, I had read Raymond Chandler, but he felt tonally so alien. I couldn't, you know, there's no way that I could think of that. That's what it was. It's such great relaxation to read someone like Raymond Chandler, because it feels so unrelated to what I write that I can still read as a reader. I don't read as a writer. And yet,
I think there's certainly talk of a movement of Scottish noir these days.
I do read those Denise Mina and Val McDermott and Ian Rankin and Craig Robertson. I read them. I didn't initially want to write that kind of... Someone in an early interview said, now, you're Scottish, but this isn't tartan noir. And I thought, okay, go on. That's not, you know, it's not something to...
Very observant, yes.
You know, I'm allowed to write whatever I want. I read them, and I love them, but they weren't, that wasn't my way in. And actually, the standalones the first thing I wrote that wasn't the 1920s series was kind of based on this linguistics PhD that was about how to interpret references to non-existent objects. So it turned into a time travel caper that I called Save Elvis, because that's the first job of a time traveller. But the publishers didn't go for that title, unfortunately. And it wasn't a crime novel. And my experience, this is where I turn into Jodie Pico, but we can maybe segue into Sisters in Crime from here. My experience of writing a novel that wasn't in the crime genre while being female was in itself like time travel. It felt like being in the early 60s, because it was fiction and I'm a woman, so it was women's fiction. So I had to soften it and bump up the love interest and take this out. And it was a really strange experience, and it made me think, I like the mystery genre, because that you can, no one, you know, you're so free. You can do anything. It's such a broad church. And I decided then that any story that I ever wanted to tell would be somewhere in the crime genre. So that's how I got to the modern ones.
Let's take that segue opportunity.
Okay.
So I was thinking about this, and I by the way, I should start out by saying I'm a member of Sisters in Crime. But is Sisters irrelevant now? Here we have a year in which Sarah Paratsky, one of the founders of Sister in Crime, is now the president of the Mystery Writers of America. Does that mean that Sisters has become irrelevant?
No, not at all. I mean, that's a great statement of the Obama problem, you know, that as soon as President Obama got into office, he couldn't really talk about the problem of institutionalized racism because he's a black man and he's a president, so it doesn't exist anymore, right? So he doesn't, you know, he doesn't. And Frankie Bailey talked about that in just those terms, who's an African-American writer who was the president of Sisters in Crime 4 years ago, 3 years ago. That as soon as she became the president, she found it very hard to talk about wider diversity, especially about writers of colour. No, I don't think so. And I think it's... I'm going to have to tread quite carefully here, because I don't think it's a difference between the UK and America. But I think the UK tradition of crime writing is really, really female, because it's Agatha, Marjorie, Dorothy L. Sayers, Ruth Rendell, P.D. James, Val McDermott, you know. Whereas the American, the birth of American crime writing is much more male. It's like it's Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, and it feels more male. I think for a British person, think of a crime writer, the vision that you get might be a woman. Like, think of a nurse, the vision that you get is a woman. Whereas
well,
I think in America,
You're talking to somebody, however, who is steeped in the male British crime writers. Certainly, Conan Doyle's era, the women crime writers were few and far between. And that change really didn't happen until Christie came along. I mean, before that, certainly the early Golden Age mysteries are all men.
Yeah, I can't believe I forgot to say Conan Doyle to you. I'm sorry, Les.
That's
sorry.
Quite all right.
Anyway, I think a lot has changed since Sarah Paratsky rolled up her sleeves in the late 80s and said, "Oh, look, this is ridiculous. Come on, let's get this straightened out." But I think it's up to 36% reviews of female writers in the broadsheets that have still got reviews these days. I think last year was 36% off the top of my head. And I think now the kind of dismissal and marginalisation is of writers of colour, native writers and LGBTQ writers is where female writers was in the late 80s. So quite a lot of the reason that I took on the presidency was because the new strategic plan for Sisters in Crime, the new five... Is it a five-year plan? No, the new... It's not a five-year plan. It's a for as long as it lasts, Anne, was to look at inclusion across the board of all writers. So not forgetting women, but also LGBTQ writers and writers of colour. And I thought, you know, I can be really fierce and really annoying for gay writers and black writers, and nobody can, you know, I'm not whining for me. It's easier to be fierce for someone else. So that's some of what I was interested in doing.
MWA has been wrestling with the, I'll say, question of self-published writers. Where is Sisters on this issue about admitting self-published writers as active members, as real professional writer members?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Sisters in Crime has never differentiated between any member. That's why we never give awards. We give grants. We have drawings. We don't give awards. We don't put one writer above another writer. And at the moment, how it's going is broader and broader and broader, and everyone in the same big, what's the noun I'm after here? Pile? That doesn't sound good.
Tent.
Party.
Tent.
The same,
yeah,
tent.
Party. That's I love party. That sounds so much more fun.
Heap. Yeah. And it's, to be perfectly frank, it's not something I know anything about, because I began this caper in, you know, the early Jurassic period, 2001. It was, everything I know is completely irrelevant about paths into publishing now, which is a shocking admission, to be frank. And I don't think any one president can do everything.
Well, so my personal hope is that with you and Sarah at the reins of MWA and Sisters, that there will be a great deal of turmoil.
For Sarah, it might be deliberate turmoil. My fear is that turmoil would just happen as I, you know, just come along behind me. But where are we? End of February. It's almost March now, and it hasn't happened yet.
Perhaps you'd wish to think of this podcast as your opportunity to create turmoil.
I probably managed that already. But perhaps that job's done. We can tick that box and move on. Yeah, the self-publishing. I don't know. I mean, horribly, horribly interesting times, isn't it? I think anyone who says they know where publishing is going to be in 10 years' time is lying, or at least deluded. How it feels for me as a writer is that the tree's being shaken really hard, and I'm holding on, and I just hope that if the tree stops shaking, I'll still have a grasp of the branch where I am. But it's overwhelming, and I think moving to a different country when I did in 2010, so that as publishing changed, I didn't know how much of what seemed alien to me was brand new, and how much of it was just the US instead of the UK. I did feel quite fogged over.
So you personally have not put your toes into the water? You haven't republished your backlist or tried self-publishing audio or any of the things that are now happening?
I haven't, no, not yet. I would rather write another book. I'd rather write an extra book than three writers than a writer and an editor and a publisher, because one of the good things about having had the calamitous experience of academia is I know exactly how it feels when I'm doing something I'm no good at. I recognise that feeling almost instantly. I've got great admiration for people who roll their sleeves up and say, I'm going to write this book, edit it, I'm going to design it, promote it, market it, I'm going to distribute it, I'm going to do the whole thing. I suspect I might end up in a corner with a blanket over my head if I try to do that, which sounds feeble, but we can't, you know, we can't all do everything. Well, yeah, but then there's Hank. If I'd been less easily led, so a careers advisor told me when I was 13, I think 13 or 14, asked, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, I want to be a writer. I want to write novels. And she said, and I quote, oh, don't be so daft. You're a clever girl. You should stay on at school and, you know, make a serious choice. So I did. I mean, that's how it was. I think, you know, it's like it was a very blue-collar background. It was a small East Coast Scottish state school, and people like me didn't become writers. So I stayed on at school till I was 35 because I'm such a good girl. And I think maybe if it hadn't, you know, if I'd just met someone else that day, or if she hadn't been quite as she was, if someone had said, oh, that's interesting, I wonder, you know, what would you, how can I help you towards that? Then I might have started a bit earlier than I did. I don't know why I'm talking about this. There's this counterfactual reality I'm thinking. Maybe if I'd started when I was 25, I would have missed the great upsurge and had to pack it in, get a proper job before self-publishing happened, and I wouldn't have to have a view.
Well, but you might have had to. I mean, you. I think part of the answer is you wouldn't have had the things to say at 25 that you have today. I mean, I kick myself around the block all the time. Why did I wait till I was in my 50s to start writing? And, you know, it's a matter of time and place, in part.
And also, having trained, you know, for 9 years to do a job that you then realized you hated and were hopeless at, but with all the pride, I was the first person in my family to go to university, so such pride, you know, of my parents that I was a university lecturer, and they thought when I left my job to write stories, they thought I was having a breakdown. They didn't think it was a career move at all. They thought it was a meltdown. Seriously,
she's gone mad.
Yeah, exactly. This is crazy. But if I hadn't had the experience of knowing how awful it is to be stuck in a job, you know, like, oh, just my luck, I've got a permanent tenured position in a good university. Poor me. I just have to stay here till I'm dead. And I think that, you know, when people ask, you know, how do you make yourself write every day? How do you make yourself do it when no one's standing over you? And I think the experience of finally finding the right thing to do makes that a lot easier.
You're in a fortunate position, Kat. I mean, you know, as president of Sisters, I know you know that there are many, many writers who cannot afford to be full-time writers, and they have to stay in their day jobs that they dislike. I remember the first time I ever went to an MWA function. It was a luncheon, and I looked around the table, and there were 10 writers there whose names I knew and admired, and every one of them had a day job.
Day job. Well, this is, I know, I flounced off from that job. I packed it in before I had a publisher, an agent. I hadn't written anything. I'd had a little story published in the Bunty when I was 9. Don't know what the equivalent of the Bunty would be. It's a girl's comic. But that's how I chose the name of my detective's dog. The dog's called Bunty, as homage to my first piece of published writing. However, my most serious piece of advice for any writers is, if you're going to have a series that goes on in real time, don't have a dog.
Right.
I have managed successfully to dodge the question about self-publishing. It's a better career plan, isn't it? It must be, especially if you've got a backlist. I mean, and I think that's sometimes what kind of annoys me about great ambassadors for self-publishing. If they're talking to a room full of people writing their first novel, and they're talking as a self-published writer who got their backlist of 10 titles to right. then put out a month at a time, that feels a bit disingenuous.
Yes, and I think there's a great difference between those. I mean, I was a part of the committee of MWA struggling with the topic for standards for so-called active members. And the question is a question of what makes a professional. Is it that some third party edits your work? Is it that you get rejected by a publisher? Is that what makes you a professional? But I was reflecting there that although we feel like we're in a new world and struggling with issues that nobody's ever thought about before, when you go back to the history of MWA, which is now 60-something years old, there was the same debates about paperbacks, whether paperback writers were real writers.
Yeah.
And should be permitted to become members. And this is why, of course, we have a category called paperback originals in the Edgars. So.
And I'm very glad that the Edgars does have a category of paperback originals. Yay! And you do hear, it's salutary to remember that, yeah. And we forget about paperback. I don't have that at all. I think my absolutely favourite format as a reader is the trade paperback. It's the easiest to read. It's floppy. It's got that nice kind of... It just feels... It's my favourite object. And I'm published by Midnight Ink in paperback and by Minotaur in hardback and then little paperback. What do you call it? Mass market paperback.
Right.
And maybe that's just more of my handy oblivion that I should feel inferior to be published in paperback.
A lesser being.
I don't. Sure. Although they are bringing out a hardback later in the year as part of their 10th birthday celebration. And they have chosen me to be that hardback, which is lovely.
I appreciate all of your standalones and your... your sort of, what did I call it, benign sinisterness. I'm wondering, but you answered the question, there will be another Dandy novel coming soon, I take it?
Yeah, I'm writing one right now, 62,000 words in. Not that I'm counting. so it's on the go. Oh, there's one in the pipeline and then this other one on the go.
So the one in the pipeline we'll see in 2015 or 2016?
2015, November 2015 in the US, I think. And then July 2015, the UK is a book ahead. So July 2015, they come out in the UK first and then the following November in the US until it stops. I'm at 1933 now, I think. And I've got a really good idea for 1936, so I'd like to get to there. And then we'll see how it goes. I don't know how you know when a series is finished.
I think that's a question a lot of writers who have fallen into series have asked themselves. I mean, you've got someone like Lee Child who says, I think, is it 23?
21 and out.
As a 21 and out as a homage to Travis McGee.
Oh, okay.
But other writers struggle with that.
It depends on who you ask, Kat. Of course, your publishers would say never. I assume they say to you what I've heard from other series writers, which is, we loved your last book. We'd like another one just like it, except different.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly the same and totally different. That's right. Yeah. My editor, my initial editor in London, Susie Dory, who I call Editrix Lestrange, she is another firmly, you know, like strictly professional relationship. So I tweet to her, the nuns are coming. And she tweets back, wearing my jersey over my head and running around the office squealing, you know. So we have a lot of fun. She keeps being promoted. She's the director of fiction at Hodder and Stoughton now, and every time she's promoted, I think she's going to stop editing. She's going to stop, but she doesn't.
Well, lucky for you. So, I mean, you know, the answer is, from the reader's point of view, we want you to end the series when it's not something you want to do anymore. That's when you're tired of it. Please stop, because the readers will get it.
Yeah.
One of the problems, Sherlock Holmes is one of the examples of probably Conan Doyle not stopping when he was tired of it, and it shows in many of the later stories.
Yeah. I've got a great idea for 1972 as well, and she could be alive in
1972. She could be, absolutely.
I'd start skipping years. I mean, that's crazy. And I don't want to write, you know how I want to write circuses and boarding schools and department stores, I don't really want to have to write about the Second World War. So that might be the absolute backstop.
Thanks so much for doing this, Kat.
Thank you, Kat. I'll see you. Bye.
Love to meet you, Nancy. Thanks for what you said, Nancy. That means a lot.
Oh.
Thank you.
Sure. Next week, Les and I speak to Sarah Poretsky, the best-selling author of the V.I. Warshawski series and the current president of the Mystery Writers of America. Until then, this is Nancy Clare. Thank you for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.